In the news.
Hey there, I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for Introduction to American and Texas Government.
Week two, three? Where are we? Where are we at?
I think this is week three.
Yeah, I'm not even sure. Okay.
Well, yeah, sheet says week three. All
right. Sheet says week three, and we go by the sheet. All right, we're trying to move a little bit off Trump and Russia and the Kavanaugh nomination, these things we've been talking about kind of all summer. So we're going off the board a little bit here today in our choice of topics. With that, we've got four topics today. I'm only contributing one. Professor McDaniel did the lion's share of the work this week, but I think you'll like my contribution. I decided that of all the things in the world I want to talk about this week, I want to talk about monkey selfies. Let's go to CNN, which has a nice little video on a recent case.
A long court fight over a monkey selfie has finally been decided. You heard me right.
That's right.
This is the photo at the center of the legal battle. This was taken in 2011 by a 7-year-old crested, macaque named what?
Macaw named Naruto.
Naruto is his name. Is it a him or her? I don't even know. Naruto actually took photographer David Slater's camera from him, snapped the selfie after watching humans do it. Monkey see, monkey do. Slater published the photo in a book 3 years later and was sued by the animal rights group PETA, which claimed Naruto owned the rights to the selfie since Naruto, he snapped it. I guess it's a him. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals coming down in favor of Slater, ruling, quote, the monkey lacked statutory standing because the Copyright Act does not expressly authorize animals to file copyright infringement suits.
The monkey lacked statutory standing. All right? That's the key phrase, my friends. That monkey lacks statutory standing. So, all right, I think this is kind of... Let me try to pretend that it has a lot of relevance to what we're talking about in the course. Actually, there are a couple things I wanted to mention. First is this question of standing and the courts, you know, ruling on things and using the question of standing as kind of the basis for not ruling on certain things is a big deal. A lot of the cases that the Supreme Court just handled in the last session, most of the cases coming down in June, involved questions of standing. You know, does somebody suing, does somebody bringing a claim, do they actually have standing to bring that claim? This was kind of a big deal in some of the Obamacare cases when, you know, there were groups who just didn't like Obamacare and they sued. And a lot of times the court would throw the cases out saying, you don't have standing. That is, you are not materially harmed by this. And so I don't care that you don't like it. You do not have standing, right? There are a lot of things out there that you guys may not like, but you can't sue unless you personally are kind of involved in the case and experience some harm, right? So in this particular case, as you guys have seen, the anchors on CNN could barely contain their, you know, laughter on this. But, you know, there was a guy who was taking pictures. I think this was 2011 or something like that. Or maybe it happened in 2009 and the guy was trying to publish these things in 2011. But he had, according to his story, established relations with the monkeys so that they were comfortable around him. He left his camera, went off, did whatever he did, came back, and Naruto, who I believe is a male, had taken a picture of himself. So the guy, you know, later on puts together this sort of wildlife book of photographs. Then they get posted online without the guy's consent, right? So in fact, let me make sure I'm getting the right entity here. It was, let's see, I want to make sure it's the particular, it wasn't Wikipedia or anything like that, but it was an online site who published the pictures of the monkey, and the guy who'd taken the pictures said, no, you have to pay me. And the company said, like, well, wait a sec. You didn't take the pictures. You know, you're not actually the photographer here. The monkey is the photographer. Therefore, and the monkey doesn't have any rights to the picture. Therefore, the pictures are in the public domain. So that's kind of the reasoning of the case, right? Guy wants to be paid for use of his pictures. You know, website says they're not really your pictures. They're the monkey's, except the monkey has no standing or has no right. Therefore, they're in the public domain. And so that's kind of the suit. The guy claims, by the way, that he's sort of going broke. He's got no money. You know, he needs the money from the monkey selfies, which is a sad commentary in and of itself. But at any rate, that's the kind of gist of the case. And that goes back and forth. But then PETA, All right, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I got that right. It's People. Yeah, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. PETA gets involved. Now, does PETA have an agenda in this case? Well, of course. It's an interest group. PETA comes in, and PETA's interested in establishing animal rights, including animal legal rights. So PETA comes in and says that, in fact, you know, the monkey owns this. You know, the monkey owns the rights to this. It's not the case that the monkey doesn't have any kind of claim here. So PETA comes in and sues. It works its way through the court system, and then you end up, it goes all the way through, and then this April, the Ninth Circuit Court, which is the court associated, and you'll see this when Professor McDaniel and I's, when you see our modules on the judicial system in the United States, the Ninth Circuit Court is essentially the West Coast, the Left Coast Circuit Courts. The Ninth Court takes these, it's a matter of appeal, so it's an appellate jurisdiction case. The court takes the case, and the court actually upholds the notion that the monkey lacks standing in the case. Right, so, and they said PETA, in fact, they kind of slapped PETA down a little bit here. What they said was, I got to make sure I get this right. They said, the Ninth Circuit Court, all right, first of all, a little backup here. It says, you know, one question you may have, this is an article I'm reading about the case, was can PETA actually do this? Under the Ninth Circuit precedent, so the Ninth Circuit Court has heard cases like this before, and this the precedent here is a case called Cetacean versus Bush. Now, for those of you out there who have a biology background, you know what cetaceans are. This was a case where a self-appointed attorney for all the world's whales, porpoises, and dolphins sued over the Navy's use of sonar. Okay, so PETA had done this before. Right, and in that case, what the Ninth Circuit Court ruled was that animals do not have standing unless Congress clearly writes it into a statute. And so in this case, so there was a precedent case, Cetacean versus Bush. Bush had a tough run. Right, you know, the Ninth Circuit Court already ruled on this, and that precedent was used in this case. Right, so in this case, and in fact, when the Ninth Circuit Court ruled, they said, in fact, PETA seemed not to actually be all that interested in Naruto. They were more interested in, quote, their own agenda. So, you know, the Ninth Circuit Court slapping down PETA in the Naruto case, it's a tough ruling. But at any rate, so the monkey selfie case at this point has been resolved. The question of animal rights, now, if you're coming out of here thinking like, well, you know, Shaw's kind of making fun of it. No, there is a legit question of animal rights, obviously, but you know, what the court rules in this case or kind of upholds precedent that unless Congress writes it into the statute, right, that animals do not have standing in cases involving specific constitutional rights and guarantees, right? So that could always change if Congress writes it into statutes, but at this point, it's not simply a matter of constitutional law. All right, so that's all I got in the monkey case. Any thoughts? Any insight into the Naruto case?
Well, I think the key thing about this is that the Ninth Circuit Court made this decision, and the Ninth Circuit Court is known for being liberal. So think of Texas being in the Fifth Circuit, known for making conservative decisions. The fact that they, you could argue they did some venue shopping and tried to find a liberal district for this appeal, and they struck it down, was pretty much a strong sign that this won't happen again. And again, this is not to belittle PETA. I mean, it is right. A bit of a funny story, but PETA does provide a service. It does provide an issue of ideas. We think of animal rights. If you think of the way in which animals are treated on farms, so you have a lot of discussions regarding, you know, the mistreatment of animals on farms and what does this mean in terms of the meat that humans consume. But then also there's this argument that the way in which we treat animals is also a reflection of how we treat each other. And so if we can basically treat animals any way we want to, then how does that prevent us from doing that to each other? So PETA does have, PETA does play a role.
And it's an interest group. PETA's an interest group like these other interest groups we've been talking about. It's advocating a particular point of view.
Yeah.
You know, we'll talk a little bit about, you know, interest groups and you know, First Amendment rights and stuff a little later on, but yeah.
Oh yeah, I mean, and again, this is something where it's easy to paint them as a fringe group. I mean, there are some things that PETA does where people can easily be painted as a fringe group, but there are some core things that in your day-to-day you may not realize that PETA's played a role in. And so, but at the same time, again, when you're an interest group, you're trying to make some headway. Sometimes you either go big or go home, and this is their attempt to go big.
Well, I think, you know, to Professor McDaniel's point, you know, we might all agree, maybe we don't, but we might all agree that, you know, monkeys owning copyrights on, you know, selfies is probably a bridge too far. But what if we took it back to more basic rights, you know, right to life, for you know, do animals have, you know, or, you know, right not to be, you know, brutalized or, you know, treated unethically or harmed. You know, these are things that, you know, when we start talking about those, well, okay, you know, we may not think monkeys have the copyrights when it comes to selfies, but when it comes to more basic rights, I think people, you know, it's a continuum. Yeah. And where you draw the line with respect to animal rights is a matter of negotiation, and PETA is aggressively negotiating for a much more expansive view of those rights.
Yeah, and again, this is not to belittle PETA, but it's also not to say PETA is the greatest thing ever, but to say, look, they're part of this competition, part of this negotiation, and, you know, usually when you do a negotiation, you ask for the sun, the moon, and the stars, knowing you won't get it, but you get a little something. And so they're trying to move it in a certain direction, and again, go big or go home.
Yeah. Okay, a couple other things we want to talk about. What do you got on your docket, Professor?
So one of the first things that I guess we're going to talk about two things that relate to the Trump administration. So, well, first, dealing with the response to tariffs. Then second, the Democrats' response to the Kavanaugh nomination. One of the first things is we're seeing that the Trump administration is setting up a relief to farmers who've been harmed by the tariffs. I believe it's a $12 billion relief effort. And this is something, a part of a program that has been within the Department of Agriculture for years, and they don't need congressional approval. And so there's a bit of Democrats aren't happy about this, and even you have a number of Republicans who aren't happy about this because they're upset about the tariffs. And specifically tariffs on things to soybeans, or one of the things you're seeing is that increased tariffs on certain products. And so what it makes it more expensive for people who import certain goods from overseas. But you're also finding individuals who are exporting goods that, because President Bush has presented tariffs for certain goods, that these other countries are responding by putting tariffs on other goods. And you're finding that soybean farmers in particular have been harmed by this, where the tariffs against China's put tariffs on the soybeans. And so because of that, they've lost a lot of money. And so the Trump administration is basically, I wouldn't call it a bailout, but in many ways, it's a way to help subsidize them to ease the pain that the tariffs have caused. And again, there's a lot of pushback because many people say, look, tariffs are just taxes. So you have many Republicans who are, you know, want low taxes, and they see tariffs as just another tax. Others see this as, you know, you created a problem and this is your way of solving it. Just get rid of the problem altogether. And so it's a really interesting thing to see how it's being played out. But then also you have those, again, are skeptics saying, look, you had a lot of farmers who supported the president. And so the president realized this is his base and he hurt his base. So he has to find some way to protect his base. But also many see this as a short-term relief to really a long-term problem. Now, the key thing about this is you don't need congressional approval. So Congress may be upset about this. Members of Congress may be upset about this. But the Trump administration argues they don't need congressional approval for this to basically have this to spread this $12 million to help ease the pain caused by the tariffs.
You know, the question of tariffs has been controversial. Yeah, I'm a electoral politics guy and a coalitional politics guy. I always, you know, tend to see things through the prism of elections and the groups that support the Democrats on the one side and Republicans on the other. And, you know, as I think I mentioned last week, but this is a really interesting gamble or, you know, kind of outreach on the part of President Trump. I mean, he shook things up. Generally speaking, you know, farmers, blue-collar whites in particular, have been Democratic constituents. You know, they've been a group that's been core to the Democratic Party since the New Deal and Franklin Roosevelt. And, you know, Trump has made a real effort to reach out to them with this sort of populist rhetoric, with this economic rhetoric, by, you know, going after other countries and groups that he thinks are threatening, that these, you know, people see as kind of upsetting their position or role in American society. So I find this interesting. I see it as simply a matter of, you know, policy. He made these policy commitments. He's going to honor them. He wants to retain their support, not only in 2018, but more particularly in 2020. So I think this makes sense from Trump's perspective politically. But as Professor McDaniel suggested, it's a big public policy question now, and there are implications. And other countries don't just roll over when the United States says we're going to impose, you know, tariffs on your goods. I think there's a sense that the United States has probably been, you know, kind of as low tariffs, has allowed imports, and hasn't really charged other countries much for their exports. We haven't been very aggressive in exploiting markets like Japan, which traditionally has enormous tariffs protecting Japan's economy from American auto imports and even more particularly American rice imports. Any of you guys are from Houston or in the basin where there's a lot of rice production know, you know, those Asian markets are really tough to crack into. They do not want American rice coming in because American rice generally is cheaper and more plentiful, right? So this is kind of a long-standing issue. Trump is playing to, you know, a notion in American society which is pretty pervasive, and that is that, you know, the trade kind of structure right now is unfair. America operates at a disadvantage. We pay more to our workers. We don't have high tariffs protecting certain industries. And so Trump is playing into that. But other countries respond in kind, right? They impose their tariffs, et cetera. So as Professor McDaniel said, as the farmers kind of take a little bit of the brunt here, that is, as other countries raise their barriers to American, you know, agricultural goods, how do you kind of get through that? I'm kind of the opinion that I think this is in some ways a negotiating ploy, these tariffs, that, you know, you hit the tariffs, impose the tariffs, and then the other country responds and you negotiate some sort of settlement. I think that's the way Trump operates. I assume that's what's going on here. But there is this question of, in the meantime, when people actually experience difficulties because international trade is a complex thing. And, you know, when international markets dry up, real Americans get hurt. So anyway, we'll see. We'll see how this works out.
Oh, yeah. And so the next thing we want to move on to is going back to the Kavanaugh nomination, but not so much talking about his credentials, things of that nature, but how Democrats are responding. So Democrats have highly criticized and you have Republicans as well, the Citizens United decision. Specifically, there's an aspect of this which allows organizations to make statements, not necessarily endorse candidates, but make political statements or make statements about policy, about nominees, things of that nature, and not report who their donors are. And so many others must report who their donors are. In this case, certain organizations, they don't. And so it's referred to as dark money. You don't know where the money is coming from. Now, the Supreme Court has ruled that the majority of this money must be spent on something that does not deal on non-campaign. And so they see a judicial nominee as an example of this. This is not a campaign, this is a judicial nominee. And you're seeing that the Democrats, who in the past have been outspent 20-1 in regards to this, are now saying, look, we may be outspent again, but as opposed to 20-1, it'd be 6-1. And so we're going to start using this dark money as a way to wage a campaign to make it clear how we feel about the Supreme Court nominee. And again, so this is kind of a new tactic, and this is an organization that was started by a former aide to President Obama and to Hillary Clinton as a way to raise money and to, in many ways, for the Democrats to get involved and kind of get their voice heard in regards to, or Democratic supporters to get their voice heard in regards to the Kavanaugh nomination.
A couple things to point out. Let's make sure everybody is on the same page with this here. The Citizens United decision, which was in 2009, is a very important case in campaign finance law. What the court ruled in Citizens United was that groups, unions, trade associations, any kind of special interest group, actually interest group generally doesn't have a special interest, has the same First Amendment speech protections that individuals do. In other words, if Coca-Cola or the NAACP or MALDEF or any of these organizations, sort of more or less political, decide they want to go out and say something political, that they're entitled to free speech protections. In other words, you cannot regulate that speech. Now, these groups and entities, if they want to contribute directly to political campaigns, have to go through the federal election campaign system, and they're subject to limitations in terms of how much they spend and coordination with the campaign. But this is something different. This is what we call independent expenditures. If they just want to go out and say what they want to say, air an advertisement, if they want to go out and say, we hate free trade, we really want high tariffs, The court ruled in Citizens United, they can do that. They can do that. That they have, the groups have the same free speech protections as individuals, right? Which, by the way, is kind of, Professor McDaniel and I were talking before class, it's sort of consistent with the Supreme Court's jurisprudence throughout American history. A lot of the rights in the constitutions that you and I would read and sort of say obviously refer to individuals, the court has been more expansive in their interpretation. They say that a lot of those rights apply to groups as well. And this is an instance of that. So, in the aftermath of Citizens United, everybody got freaked out. They thought, oh my gosh, all these groups are going to spend tons of money, you know, advocating for political positions in campaigns and in public policy debates. And there's been a little bit of that, you know, not as much as people might have expected, but there's a lot of money now spent by interest groups and causes and, you know, kind of people with any kind of, you know, angle on politics, right? They just go out and air their own advertisements and put them out there, right? And that's protected speech. Okay. Now, however, when we refer to dark money, what dark money is it's referent to a particular kind of interest group. If you guys look at the IRS code, and I would highly encourage you to do that, there's something called a C4 designation, a C5 designation, and a C6, 401. It's 401C4, 401C5, 401C6. 401C4 is essentially a social welfare group. And, you know, so you organize, you file with the IRS as a social welfare group, and it basically says you're out there doing good stuff, stuff to promote the good, and as long as no more than 49.99% of your work is political, you can keep that C4 designation as a nonprofit, right? So this is, again, a tax designation. C5s, I think, I want to make sure I'm clear on this because I goof this up occasionally. A C5 versus a C6, let me make sure I get this right. Let's see, a C5 is a union and a C6 is a trade association, right? So these are all nonprofits. Now, these groups, why do we care about nonprofits and IRS designations? These groups do not have to disclose their donor lists. So, if you're a C4 or a C5 or a C6, you can raise unlimited amounts of money from individuals or groups. Then you can turn around and put out an advertisement advocating against, say, Kavanaugh's nomination. And that is completely permissible. So the dark money reference is kind of looking at this aspect of these groups, refers to the fact that these groups do not have to disclose their donor lists. So if, you know, McDaniel's got some corporation, he wants to give $5 million to a C4, he can do that. That group can turn around and use that money as part of a pot to air on these advertisements. And we don't know where their money came from. We don't know that McDaniel and his cronies, you know, were behind that money. So that's the dark part of the dark money, right? And this is in juxtaposition to traditional campaign finance laws, which require you that you disclose your donors. So for instance, a PAC, a political action committee, you have to say where your money comes from. Candidates have to say where their money comes from. They have to provide lists of donors to the Federal Election Commission, right? So this is one of those things that's developed in campaign finance and in, you know, money and politics in the last 5 or 10 years that has people kind of freaked out a little bit. And as Professor McDaniel was saying, it's come up in this instance. Democrats have been very kind of critical of the Citizens United decision and dark money generally. They think it's sort of nefarious. There's a general sense amongst Democrats that this money tends to come in on behalf of Republican candidates and causes, right? So they're kind of, I think they probably have an ethical problem with it, but they also have a partisan problem with it, right? So this is an instance where Democrats who've been moaning about dark money and Citizens United for years are using it to their advantage, right? And that's kind of the novel development. It's interesting. And like as Professor McDaniel said, it's a way for Democrats who are kind of freaked out about the court and where it's going to be involved, right? You know, contribute money to one of these social welfare organizations, that social welfare organization goes out there and pounds Trump and Kavanaugh on this nomination, hoping to move public opinion and maybe ditch this nominee. I think that's what's...
Yeah, and another reason why you see Democrats opposed to this is because it's seen as a benefit for corporations. And so if Democrats present themselves as the working class, the anti-corporation, they're going to take any decision that's seen as positive for corporations. Oh, this is bad, even though it may benefit them. So part of this is a bit of gamesmanship.
Yeah, and this is part of the Bernie Sanders and the Elizabeth Warren wing of the Democratic Party that's really kind of talking about all these, you know, big moneyed interests that come in and tilt, you know, the system in usually corporate, yes, you know, in favor of corporate entities. But, all's fair, right? And in this instance, I haven't heard a lot about, you know, Bernie and Liz coming out complaining about this is going. So
if it benefits you, you keep very quiet. If it benefits, yeah, if it doesn't benefit you, you raise holy hell.
It is interesting. I mean, I've made this case in the interest group part of the class, but the notion that all these corporations are out there and that they're all conservative, I think, is a pretty strong misnomer. I mean, you see a lot of major, you know, corporations out there that have a Democratic or a liberal or progressive slant or sensibility, and they give money too. Yeah. So I think corporations basically want to back a winner more than anything else.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And at the end of the day, it's they're about, the key thing is survival, and you don't survive by hanging with losers.
All right, well, we got another fourth and final.
All right, so fourth and final topic, we're actually going back to rights, and this is moving kind of from an issue of national politics to local politics. And this deals with the state of Michigan, in particular, the public school system in the city of Detroit. The federal court actually threw out a suit against the state of Michigan. And the schools and the school system in the state of Detroit sued, arguing that because the schools had very few resources, so overcrowded classrooms and very few teachers, or lacking books, things of that nature, so the basic things you need for an education, that the state had violated their rights. And the federal court ruled that no, there is no right to literacy, there is no right to education. While the court ruled that, yes, a good education is critical, it is extremely important for understanding the advancement of society, for being able to vote, have a job, it is not a right. And so what you have here is this concern about what does this mean, specifically in the state of Michigan, where you have, you have the Flint water crisis, where it was clearly mismanagement on the part of the state. And it's argued that you have mismanagement of the education system in Detroit on the part of the state. And again, you have Flint and you also have Detroit, two relatively low resource but heavily minority areas. And it's seen as if the state is attacking these populations. But in addition to this layer with to this, especially dealing with public schools, is that Michigan is really one of the states for advancement of charter schools. So if you think of Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos, you know, she started her charter school kind of empire in Michigan. And so this is seen, and there's really this fear that the state of Michigan is really trying to choke out the public schools in order to help out the charter schools. And so this has really been a big issue. This is, again, a bigger concern, but also going back to whether or not an education is a right, is an issue that's been up for debate for quite a bit. So there's a discussion of, you know, certain school districts have much more resources and are better than other school districts. And so basically moving 5 miles in one direction could drastically change the educational resources you have. And many have argued that it will drastically change your potential life outcome. And if we see education as a right, well, then that means we have to make sure everybody gets an equal education. That means people can put more demands on the state to make sure that their children are being properly educated. But one of the problems we know with education is that education is a service, not a good. So whereas if you have a bad car, like, oh, this car isn't working, you can return it and replace it. If you get a bad education, you can't really replace that. And sometimes it's very difficult to tell if you have a bad service until really it's too late. So in many cases, we're dealing with doctors. You don't know if a doctor made a mistake until further down the line, and sometimes you can't repair that mistake. So education is really one of these weird things that we realize is essential and we realize is important, but we have a hard time understanding, okay, what exactly is a good education? We may know what a good education is 20 years after it's been done, but we don't know what a good education is at that time. And furthermore, what qualifies as a good education changes as the demands of the public or demands of the industry change. And so this is a slippery slope and kind of a messy situation messy situation. But again, it comes back to this issue of rights and what types of things the public can demand on the part of government. So if you're saying you have certain rights, you can make demands on government to fulfill certain things. And the federal court ruled that education, while important, is not a right. And so because of this, this may change the way in which we understand the public education system, but then also the way in which make demands upon states to provide certain levels of public education.
Yeah, it's a great conversation. I mean, one of the things I'll be quick and get out. We taxed your patience enough today, I think. But you know, conservatives, and especially getting back to the Kavanaugh nomination, conservatives think that liberals and progressives have been too expansive in their conception of rights, right? That you have a constitution that says, you know, a few things. The Bill of Rights articulates, you know, right to assemble, right to religion, free speech, et cetera, trial by jury, et cetera. And that, you know, if it's not in the constitution, that, you know, it basic, and unless it's in the constitution or directly related to, you know, rights in the constitution, then, you know, what are we doing inventing? It's a word of a lot of conservatives, these rights. And this has come up a lot lately. You know, a right to education, as Professor McDaniel sort of explains in the Michigan case. We also heard this, a right to health care, when Obamacare and the controversy around Obamacare was kind of at its highest. And polls show that a lot of people do think that there ought to be a right to health care. We're still, again, to use this phrase again, we're still negotiating these. I would point out, by the way, I mean, The Constitution is pretty clear and pretty limited on the things that the federal government can do, but it's not limited with respect to rights. In fact, the Constitution is pretty clear. The Ninth and Tenth Amendments to the Constitution are underrated, in my view. And I'll kind of close with this. The Ninth, you know, Amendment to the Constitution basically says that just because we didn't put it in the first eight amendments to the Constitution doesn't mean it's not there. You know, this is one of the arguments against a Bill of Rights, which is if you expressly enumerate a set of rights, then that could be considered exhaustive, right? Anything not in that list could basically be correctly viewed as not being a right that Americans have. So in response to that, the Ninth Amendment was included in the original Bill of Rights, right? That it says, hey, just because we didn't think of it doesn't mean it's not there. And in fact, all of those unspoken rights revert to the people. So the Ninth Amendment says, you know, the federal government doesn't, you know, can't just run willy-nilly over things just because we didn't put it in the Constitution. And then the Tenth Amendment says all powers not expressly granted to the federal government are reserved to the states. So it's interesting. Ninth says, you know, all these unspoken rights, you know, they're basically go back to the people. The federal government can't touch them. Tenth Amendment says, you know, powers not granted to the federal government go to the states. So the Ninth and Tenth should be taken, I think, by you all and by, you know, kind of knowledgeable citizens, is an express statement that the Constitution really wants to define a limited federal government. Having said that, countries evolved, and this question of rights, which in many ways, ironically, is a way to unlink or to increase the powers of the federal government now. That's what's fascinating, right? The Constitution is expressly designed to limit the federal government, to define it, you know, kind of concretely, to give it more power than it had. But in doing so, they also kind of created the mechanism for increasing powers, and that is this notion that there are these other rights out there. You know, so anyway, I've said too much already, but I just want to kind of throw that out there into this context of education rights and healthcare rights, which, again, we are still negotiating. And there are a lot of people out there who think that these are fundamental rights and that, therefore, the government has an obligation to provide these sorts of things to its citizens. And, you know, keep tuned in. We're going to be talking about this stuff for a long time, I think.
Yeah, and again, the way in which rights are defined, rights are in many ways a social construct, that the way we define rights change over time, and they change based upon location. So in some countries, there is a right to education. There are certain rights that are given. And so if you go, if you refer back to the 10 Good Minutes with Professor Elkins and look at his Constitute website, you'll look at various other nations' constitutions and the rights that they give their citizens. And you compare that to the U.S. Constitution, you realize, like, oh, like, some people do see education as a right. They do see employment as a right, housing as a right. And so rights are something that are social constructions and that are constantly under debate, constantly changing. And so, you know, we may see an evolution in animal rights, and we may actually see evolution, or in some cases, a devolution of certain rights. And so it's important to be aware of this and understand that rights are not necessarily set in stone, that they are malleable, and that they can expand and contract over time. And many of this discussion of these rights are put in the hands of the courts. And so we may be able to change them in terms of a constitutional amendment, but many cases that the understanding and establishment of rights, Congress does a lot of this, but a lot of it really boils down to the courts. And so the courts play a very big role. And so we think about linking our discussion of civil liberties and civil rights with our discussion of the courts play a very big role in establishing rights. And really in three of the four topics we discussed today, it's about rights and the role of the courts in establishing these rights and what happens once these rights are established.
All right. So that's all we have for this morning or afternoon. So for Professor McDaniel and myself, I'd like to say, have a good week and we'll talk to you guys soon.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel, and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.